We have divided the session into four parts. The first discussion will be presented by Frank Cummings, a former attorney of the U.S. Senate Labor Committee and presently IEEE's Council on Government Affairs. He will outline the latest legal and legislative action on portable qualified pension plan, and in particular, IEEE's input to the U.S. legislature and its position on these. The second segment will be presented by Dick Bach, last year's chairman of the National Pension Committee and currently the chairman of IEEE's Government Relations Committee. He will bring you up to date on the latest developments of the IEEE National Pension Committee. The third portion will be presented by Bill Astrup, a partner in the firm of Post and Astrup and one of IEEE's investment counselors. Many firms sponsor their own pension plans and act as self-insurers. And it is therefore extremely important that the money set aside for the pension plans are wisely invested and the corpus protected. We therefore feel some background on the importance of your investment counselor should be brought to your attention. And finally, the fourth member of the panel will be Tom Sterno, president of Smith Sterno Organization and IEEE Members Insurance Plan Administrator. This organization has developed a variety of insurance plans for our members. Now may I introduce our first panelist, Frank Cummings.
Most people working under a pension plan are young. Most people are young. And they live under a kind of double delusion, which seems to be sort of inherent in the young. First of all, they think they are never going to grow old, which presents the biggest hurdle to a pension planner. The laws of biology simply do not apply to them. Well, if you're never going to grow old, you don't have to worry about a pension, so the problem disappears. The second delusion that they have is that if they are, quote, under or, quote, covered by a pension plan, that somehow or other means that they're going to get a pension. And that doesn't follow either, because if our studies of our members, and in fact of Americans generally, show anything, it shows, first of all, they do get old, and second of all, they don't get a pension. Now, that doesn't mean that an awful lot of people don't qualify for a pension. But I put it to you that if you just walk down the street and talk to anyone who is over the age of 65 and ask him, are you entitled to a private pension? 50% of the people you meet will tell you that the answer is no. And then take the other 50% and say, well, you say you earned a pension. How many years of your working life did you accrue that credited toward that pension? And the answer you will get from the people who were lucky enough to get a pension was that they got it from their last employer, and that their last employer was their longest employer, but it wasn't anywhere near their total working life. Maybe they made it through 15 years, which after all in this day and age is a long time to stay with one employer. But 15 years of accruals under the arithmetic of pension planning is peanuts, particularly if it's the last 15 years, because you lose the benefit of all that lovely compounding that you can get if you start early. Which brings me to my motto, which is, ironically, pensions are for the young. Why are they for the young? Because if you don't earn them when you're young, you're not going to earn them, or at least you're not going to earn enough to make the kind of a difference that you want to make. Let me give you an example. If you're earning $20,000 a year, just take down the arithmetic because it's a multiple that you can convert to anything you like. If you're earning $20,000 a year, and if you're 25 years old, you have 40 years in which to accrue a pension. Now, if you have what is considered a fairly modest but not unrespectable pension plan to which your employer is contributing 5% of your compensation, or an amount equal to 5% of your compensation, right? That's $1,000 a year. Now, if you could really sock away that $1,000 a year for the next 40 years, you would not have $40,000. You would have $284,000. Why? Because you would be putting in $250 a quarter for 160 quarters and assume an interest rate of 8%, which is 2% per quarter, compounded quarterly, which you can get in any savings and loan, tax-free while it's accumulating. And my little Hewlett-Packard calculator tells me that what you end up with at the age of 65 is $284,623, which will buy you an annuity for the rest of your life of about $28,462 a year for life And you add that on to Social Security, and by golly, you're almost making twice as much in retirement as you were making while you were working. Isn't that terrific? Why doesn't it happen? The answer is because nobody gets those 40 years. Not nobody, but hardly anybody. Put it this way, I've never met anybody who got a steady 5% contribution, fully vested, non-forfeitable, for full 40 years. Why? Nobody works 40 years for one employer. Indeed, if engineers are typical, or if what we know about electrical engineers is valid, they are so mobile, they are almost a prototype of the mobile American employee, and they're lucky if they work 5 years for anybody in a row. So when we learned this, we set about trying to devise a plan which would make it possible for our engineers to get that 40 years of accrual and to really get a decent standard of living in retirement. And by decent, I mean whatever they used to. We decided that these were the objectives we had to satisfy to do that. First of all, we needed a single plan with profession-wide coverage. Why? Because people move too fast to try to reform or to aggregate thousands of pension credits in thousands of different plans. We needed a single profession-wide plan or group of plans in a single unit. Secondly, and this is a little difficult to understand, we needed an engineers-only plan. Why? Because in any particular workforce, the odds are overwhelming that the engineers will not predominate. There will be, if it's a production, a manufacturing type of operation, there will be an hourly rated workforce, which is typically unionized, whereas the engineers are typically not. They will have their plan. There will be a salaried plan. There may be various other types of plans. And the engineers are a rather small group compared to the others. The tail can't wag the dog. It would be a terribly more difficult objective for the engineers to try to get plans changed for the universe, all 200 million Americans, in order to satisfy the particular needs of engineers who happen to be more mobile than anybody else. But we felt that if we could get this money going into our plan, just for the engineers, we wouldn't be asking employers to go change all of their plans for everyone else. Just let us deal with our money ourselves, engineers only. Thirdly, we decided that we needed immediate vesting. Now, the typical good pension plan in this country today vests in about between 10 and 15 years. Now, by vesting, all I mean is this. You have a vested pension when your accrual under the plan is non-forfeitable for any reason other than death. You can lose your job, you can quit, you can be fired, you can be laid off, you can become disabled. For one, the employer can go out of business, he can terminate the plan. Once it's vested, you cannot lose it. You still have to live to be 65 to collect it, but short of death before 65, you cannot lose it. That's vesting. An unvested pension credit is one which you have to work some more years to keep. And if for any reason you leave before you vest, you get nothing. That's why I say you can be under the plan. You can be covered by the plan. But if you're not vested, you don't own it yet. And if you're the typical engineer, you never will, because you will leave before you vest if you're under the typical plan. Even a 10-year vesting plan, which is a really good one by today's standards, isn't good enough for the typical engineer. And typically, that vesting period is coupled with age, say 10 years plus age 45, which means that you can work 20 years beginning at the age of 20, and you satisfy the length of service requirement. But if for any reason you change jobs at 40, you haven't met the age requirement, you forfeit the whole thing. So we needed immediate vesting, because to get the full 40 years, we don't want to forfeit 1 minute, 1 day of accrual. Profession-wide coverage, engineers only, immediate vesting, and tax qualification. What is tax qualification? Without tax qualification, you don't need a pension plan. All you need is a bank or a broker or whatever other investment medium you want. But the name of the game is tax qualification for this reason. There are three tax advantages to a tax-qualified plan, and these are what they are. First of all, the employer gets a tax deduction for his contribution to the plan, notwithstanding the fact that you haven't got the money yet. Normally, of course, an employer gets a tax deduction for wages, but that's money that he pays that you got. Here he's putting money aside, which you haven't got yet. Nevertheless, he gets a tax deduction. Secondly, you get a tax deferral. Even though the employer took the tax deduction, You don't accrue the income in the year in which he took the tax deduction. You don't have to pay income tax on it now. Later, maybe, but you're going to be in a lower tax bracket later. And thirdly, once the money gets into this pension plan, be it a trust, insurance contract, or what have you, the money compounds and draws income, dividends, capital appreciation, tax-free. It's a tax-exempt entity. So you get this wonderful bundle of three tax benefits in a qualified plan. What we were after was a profession-wide coverage, engineers only, immediately vested, tax-qualified. That sounds reasonable, doesn't it? So off we went to the IRS and said, here's our plan, will you qualify it? The answer was no. Why? Because engineers are, don't cringe, by definition, highly compensated. And the only rules on pension plans today are those established in the tax law, in the Internal Revenue Code, that say that a pension plan, to be tax qualified, may not discriminate in favor of highly compensated employees. Understand, the word highly compensated is a relative term compared to the rest of an employer's workforce. And we were asking for earlier vesting than the employer may be providing for his other employees. We were saying we want to set up a plan and then sell it to employers and say to employers, employer, look, you're putting away so many dollars every year into your pension plan. Some of those dollars are allocable to our engineers. Some of them are allocable to your hourly force. Some of them are allocable to your clerical force and what have you. Take the same dollars that you're now putting into your plan for us. And don't put them into your plan for us. Put them into our plan. And we will get rid of the lottery. We don't want to play roulette. We will vest every dollar pro rata in relationship to compensation from the very first day. We won't accrue as much per year, but our people will get 40 years of accrual. And there'll be no gamble in it. IRS said, nothing doing. If you don't have immediate vesting in the regular plan, you can't cut out your engineers and put them immediately vested into your plan. Well, we went to the Treasury, which, as you may not know, is different from the IRS. The IRS works for the Treasury, but not really. And the Treasury Department, the Assistant Secretary Hickman and Deputy Assistant Secretary Hall, gave us a very sympathetic reception and said that they would undertake to try to persuade the IRS to change its mind. They tried. They failed. We then decided we would take a shot at Congress. So I give you a brief dissertation on taking a shot at Congress. Jefferson, Thomas Jefferson, was my favorite fellow and wrote books on almost everything, wrote a book on the Congress, which is published by each house of the Congress, called Jefferson's Manual of Parliamentary Practice. It's a couple of hundred years old now, but it's really very pertinent. He says at the beginning of in one of the early chapters of his book as follows, quote, no one is to disturb another in his speech by hissing, coughing, or spitting, which I thought was interesting since the Senate is practically the only institution in the country left which still maintains brass spittoons. And then he goes on to say, and no one is to speak impertinently or beside the question or superfluously or tediously. The House parliamentarian who publishes this this wonderful manual put an asterisk after the word tediously and put an annotation in the footnote, not from Jefferson, which he said, neither by rule nor practice has the House ever suppressed superfluous or tedious speaking. And we learned that to our dismay because we've been at this game now for a couple of years, and although we are about to have some success, the tediousness is enough to make your skin crawl. There was a bill pending in the Senate, which has subsequently passed the Senate and passed the House and is now in the Senate House Conference to resolve differences and will be law this summer. You can make book on that, which covers basically these subject matters. None of them ideally, but every one of them to our limited advantage. And it has these basic headings: vesting, funding, fiduciary standards, quote, portability, which has nothing to do with portability, reinsurance, and enforcement. And very briefly, this is what's in the bill. The bill will require that every pension plan to remain tax qualified must provide for vesting at a relatively earlier period than many plans now do. The most likely law to emerge from the conference will require vesting of 25% of accruals after 5 years of service, scaling up to 50% after 10 years and 100% after 15 years. That's good for most people. It is not good enough for engineers, although it's an improvement, and a great many engineers will get something out of it. It provides for funding, and that's important for this reason. The pension promise is unique in American law. It is the only promise you can make in a formal document, and you don't have to keep it. Think about that. An employer can set up a pension plan, and he says, well, benefits will be 2% of final 3-year average compensation. And he says, and I will make contributions to the trust, as actuarially determined, sufficient to fund that benefit. And then the plan will say, the part you never notice, that the promise is not being made by the employer to pay the benefits. The employer only promises to make the contributions as actuarially determined. The plan promises to pay the benefits to the extent that it has the money. It never has the money, because the actuarial assumption on which it's ordinarily built is that the plan will go on and the employer will go on to infinity. Infinity is a long time, and if you ask the employees in South Bend who used to work for Studebaker how good funding is that's premised on an infinite assumption, you won't find them, because so many of them committed suicide. So there's a funding law which says you've got to put the money up over some reasonable period of time, generally 30 years, which is still a long time. Next, there's a set of prohibitions on self-dealing, running off with the money, lending it to your nephew, investing it in yourself, or what have you. Won't get into that because it's not a terribly serious problem. Next, there's a title in the bill on portability, a central portability federal clearinghouse bank, which you needn't worry about because it's voluntary and I don't believe anyone's going to join it. Next, there is a federal plan termination insurance title, which is like FDIC. If the plan shuts down before the money is in, the federal insurance fund pays off. And that makes all the difference. And finally, there's a federal agency, which is a synthesis of the Labor Department and the IRS, to enforce it all. For the first time, this business, which, believe it or not, is the biggest unregulated business in the country, with reserves of $160 billion now, going up at something like $15 billion a year, is going to have some laws to obey. Is that good enough for us? No. Why? Because we change jobs faster than that. We'll still be forfeiting. We'll never get our 40 years of accruals out of that bill, or at least most of us, most engineers, I should say. I am not an engineer. We'll not. So we said, fine, we are still the tail, we can't wag the dog, but let's see what we can get into this bill that may help engineers. First, we want a little section in the law to make the IRS change its mind and qualify that plan that the IRS had turned us down on. We went to the Senate Finance Committee, and they said, okay. We went to the House Ways and Means Committee, they said, okay. It's in both versions of the bill. While the House and Senate conferees are busily reconciling their differences, they cannot do us in because we are not a difference. Next, we said, now look, the government employs indirectly many, many engineers because they work on government contracts, and those contracts are funded by government procurement money. And when they are cost-plus or cost-reimbursable contracts, one of the reimbursable costs is pension cost. Why shouldn't the government make a condition of making pension cost reimbursable cost that the engineers really get the money? And we went to the various committees of the Congress that were marking up this bill, and we said, why don't you put a section in there that says sort of generally that to the maximum feasible extent consistent with the national interest and so on, if the government is going to reimburse to an employer the money for the employer's contribution to his pension plan, we got to get it. Now, how are they ever going to accomplish that? Well, of course, there's only one way they're ever going to accomplish that, and that's to join our plan, because that's the only plan around that's going to absolutely guarantee that the engineers get it. So we sort of had that in the back of our minds. But nevertheless, the Congress bought that provision, although there was a cliff-hanging vote in Ways and Means, and it was sustained by a vote of 10-9. And then finally, there's a third provision which provides that the Secretary of Labor shall conduct a 3-year study of the sufficiency of vesting in engineers, scientists, technical professionals, pension plans, see whether things are really improving or whether some special additional legislation is needed. Well, the bill passed the Senate 90-0 with all of that in it, passed the House, I think, 275-4. It's in conference, but I put it to you that there are no heroes here. This bill did not pass because Congress is a bunch of good guys who are out front fighting for reform. It passed because Congress, which had sat on its duff for 8 years, while the problem became more and more and more serious and the squeals of outrage became louder and louder, was finally compelled by just the sheer weight of public pressure to do this. And indeed, although the bill is now in the Senate House conference, there are people on that conference committee who are going to do everything in their power to see that that bill doesn't come out of conference. It will come out of conference, but not without some pressure on the conferees, which is already accumulating. So there are good guys, and I could list the good guys who fought for us and helped us, and there are bad guys who fought against us, perfectly honestly, I think, but they disagreed with us, as the nature of politics. I think our case was compelling. It was compelling enough so that we won everything we asked. So what's left? And Dick Bach and the others will talk to you about where we go from here. But just very briefly, when this bill passes, or indeed it now appears that the Treasury may be very well willing to relent on its ruling they turned us down on, since they can see the handwriting on the wall, we may very well get the ruling now ahead of the law, we will be in a position to set up some pension plans. We will be able to market them with this immediate vesting, engineers only, multi-employer coverage run by the societies. We will also be in a position to extend that coverage to self-employed consulting firms, KEO-type plans, with more expanded coverage. We will be in a position to offer qualified individual retirement accounts to employees who have no pension coverage from their employer, and various other things which Dick will describe to you. What we propose is to develop a comprehensive pension program specially tailored for engineers, which will give them, no matter where they work, 40 years of pension accruals. Now, you still have two problems with that. You can have all the programs in the world. First of all, you've still got to persuade employers that this is good for business, in addition to being good for their engineers. And we expect to be able to do that on the ground that once this plan gets going, you won't be able to recruit the best engineers without having the best pension plan. But it's a little bit like which came first, the chicken or the egg. No one wants to be first. Everyone wants to be second to jump on board. Secondly, you've got to persuade your members that the laws of arithmetic, biology, and so forth do apply to them, that it is impossible, short of death, not to get old, and that pensions are for the young, because if they don't start that meter running 40 consecutive years of accruals, they're going to end up with insufficient income. I'll close it off by saying that one of the things that HEW is very fond of telling people when they fight for increases in Social Security is that half the people in this country over 65 are eligible for welfare. They don't go on welfare because typically they aren't used to thinking of themselves as poor. The average older American, poor older American, always thought of himself as kind of upper middle class. He didn't discover that he was poor until he got to be 65. And he's too proud to join the ranks of people he formerly thought of as lazy. But how do you avoid that? You cannot earn that pension between the ages of 60 and 65. You're going to have a devil of a time earning it between 50 and 65. It's a breeze if you start early. We propose to provide the mechanism to solve that problem. And we propose to undertake to try to sell it to employers to protect our members and to sell it to our members so that they will sell it to themselves and to employers. It's a big project. We've been at it for a couple of years now. And where is the plan? What have we got to show for the 2 years? Well, about all we can show you up to now is a 650-page bill in conference. And nobody that I know of knows how to read it. But we have confidence that that it says what we fully expect it to say. And it's enabling law. It enables us to do our thing. We hope very much that a year from now, when we come back to describe what happened in the meantime, that this law, we know that this law will be on the books. And we hope very much that by then we'll be able to show some very tangible planning, which was impossible up to now, and now becomes not only possible, but essential.
Thank you, Frank. The next man we have is Dick Bach. Now, Dick is now president of the IEEE Legislative Committee, but he was in charge of the particular pension committee, and he worked very, very closely with Frank. And I would like him now to explain to you the status of IEEE's plans of implementing this enabling bill, or how we can do things for you people. Dick?
I am also an expert on pension legislation. I say that with absolutely no timidity or shyness because I am at least 250 miles away from home, and I have read this entire bill. And you are probably closer to home and haven't read the entire bill. But I am certainly not the expert that Frank is, and it's always very difficult to follow Frank. I thought it might be interesting at the outset to tell you how I got involved in this activity. I've been involved in it for some 3 years now. And even more important, perhaps why I got involved in it. I'm a little younger than some people that get concerned about this particular phenomena. I have now passed the magical age where life begins at. But one normally starts thinking of this, I guess, when you're, you know, beyond 50 or 60 years of old age. I also have worked for the same company, and a very good company, for 19 years. And I'm vested in my pension plan, and I have absolutely no personal problem in this regard at all. But the thing I have going for me, which probably few people in this room have going for them, is that I've got my own private pension system, because I've got six sons at home. And the way it works, and it's worked since they were little babies, every night when they were asleep, I'd creep into their room. And in a form of subliminal suggestion, I whisper into their ears, 10% for Dad. 10% for Dad. Now, you know, my theory is that they're all going to go out and they're going to get good jobs, probably as plumbers. And since plumbers make at least as much as I do, if I get 10% from each of the six of them, from my private retirement system alone, I get 60% of my income. Now, add that to Social Security and what the company's going to give me, and I have no problem at all with my personal retirement. So I thought, but my oldest son, who's now 17 going on 18, while my father was still alive, found out about a tradition from the old country that I'm told has been passed on for about five centuries in Norway, where my father's folks came from. And it seems that when the oldest son of the family is getting close to his majority, whether it's 18 or 21, he looks at poor, decrepit old Dad, weak-kneed at this point, you know, the wrinkles, the gray hair, and says, Dad, you've been working hard for us all these years. In fact, you've been working damn hard for the last 21 years. Now get out and work for yourself. And he told me that, and I decided I better get out and do something about my own retirement. In a serious vein, 3 years ago, IEEE started a pilot program to look into what could be done for members that were being laid off in droves. We started on an experimental basis then, before our charter was revised to permit us to get into these activities, a pension committee. I was extremely naive and uninformed on the subject. Mr. Cummings at the time was working for the federal government, writing a good bit of the law that preceded this. I was directed to do something for IEEE. Get us a better law. Why not? So I called up Mr. Cummings and said, hey, I work for IEEE, and we're engineers, and we got pension problems, and I want to come down and talk to you about it. And Frank probably doesn't remember this call, but I don't think I even had the most rudimentary vocabulary to address the problem. And as a very busy and hardworking employee of the government, it took him about 30 seconds to find that out. So he said, well, why don't you really go back and learn a little bit about your problem, and then we can talk. And I spent the next 30 days going through about 5,000 pages of previous government reports, textbooks, bankers, trust companies, things, studying rather hard, and called Frank up and said, hey, now I are an expert. Can we come down and talk? And from this matured what I think is an excellent relationship, both personally, but mostly in behalf of the Institute. Frank later went into private practice, is our special counsel, and has done all the good things that Bill Keyes said earlier. I break the problem down, or broke the problem down, into three parts. I guess you can categorize anything into any number of phases, but there were three distinct phases. We have gone through, I think, as of today, two of them, and we face one of the biggest ones ahead of us. The first part of the problem was we needed certain legislation or administrative rulings that would permit us to do for ourselves what most other classes of workers in the United States can do under present law. The second problem was designing the plans themselves, and inherent in designing those plans was the notion that we had to design them for the entire profession, which means we've got to get every engineer and scientist to all agree to work together and to pull in harness and let one organization of some kind do something for them. I think most people in this room have been in engineering at least as long as I have. I think you know that may be one of the biggest problems we had to resolve. If you want to see some mute evidence of this, look in the testimony we gave before the various houses of Congress, which say to the Congress of the United States, we, the engineers of the United States, we, the engineers and scientists of the United States, we, the engineers and scientists and architects of the United States, or we some kind of a group, you know, and in order to avoid alienating any of the 200-some-odd technical societies with there, it generally says something like, the engineers, scientists, and architects would like this. Or the architects, scientists, and engineers, you've got to have a permutation there periodically. Or the allied technical professionals. I bring this up to say the second phase of the program, which was designing a plan and getting joint professional society cooperation together so that we could make this plan a reality after the laws are passed, is a significant problem, and one which I think I can report has largely been overcome. The third problem, which we are just beginning to tackle, is getting employers to participate in these plans. That third big phase is going to be a long, hard pull. It's not going to come overnight. Let me recap very briefly the legislative status. Frank has reported rather fully what we're going to get out of this bill. Our follow-up efforts in legislation are going to be, for the next year or so, largely confined to trying to actively participate in any study commissions, any surveys that are taken to define just how bad this problem is. Because while the legislation we have now will go a long way to helping a lot of people a little and helping a few people a lot, it certainly isn't going to do everything that all of us would like to have done. And within two study provisions of the present law, we have another shot. It's going to be a lot easier, I think, for us to get something done through those study commissions. As Frank pointed out earlier, it would be well nigh impossible to have the ideal reform of the entire system now because so many people are affected in it and there would be so much opposition to try and create overnight by law an ideal system, an immediate vesting system. So you might say, okay, well, why do we worry about that? Why not just do it for the engineers now? Had we tried to get our ideal in the law now, which is immediate vesting for engineers, we probably would have been wiped out of the bill completely. But we did get in the notion that our problems are going to be studied, and we're going to see to what extent the provisions of this bill help us as well as all other employees in the United States. And if we're not receiving sufficient redress, then we're going to fight for additional legislation, and it probably will be easier to get because it isn't going to be part of a massive reform. We need a lot more factual information. We are going to have to conduct studies within our profession and probably cooperate with the government in conducting government-wide surveys. But at the present time, we think we know a lot about the problem. Frank outlined the problem in his talk. Let's talk a little bit more about that because I'd like to put it in a slightly different perspective. I would refer you to the bibliography in the paper that you can pick up in the center aisle there because it lists some absolutely magnificent papers, the first three of which were authored by Frank and I. And I say that they are probably the most comprehensive things you'll read on the subject, again, very modestly. We have run over the last 2 years with an IEEE, and other societies have run similar surveys to determine the profile of a typical engineer. And the profile turns out to be something like this. He's a 40-year-old individual, male or female. He has been working for 19 to 20 years. In that length of time, he's worked for 3 to 4 employers, closer to 4 than to 3. So that his average tenure with an employer is 5 years. And then we look into what is the vesting provisions for the various plans he's had. And we find out that the average vesting interval is between 10 and 15 years. Now, it doesn't even require the mathematical expertise that all we engineers have to see that on the average, this guy never vests. He needs 3 times as long with any employer as he on the average has worked. Now, I'd like to hasten to point out that I realize that such elementary statistics are certainly not giving a complete and correct picture. The old adage that if you stand with 1 foot on a hot stove and 1 foot on an iceberg, your whole body is at an average temperature of 68 degrees, but don't try and tell your feet that. The average can be very misleading. I like another story that Jerry Wilson, who was our police chief down in Washington, D.C., tells with respect to the using of statistics. because he says a lot of people use statistics to create a certain picture. But when it comes to building some credibility into your story with statistics, there are three categories of people. There are liars, and there are damn liars, and finally there are statisticians. So I profess guilty of being a statistician in this approach. But we do know from independent studies that a significant minority of engineers have constantly forfeited their pension accruals for the entire length of their career. And we're trying to further define that figure so we can go to the Congress and tell them how different we are from other workers. But we have some other differences that are, in fact, indisputable. Frank mentioned that we have a special status under IRS regulations and that we are classified higher-paid employees. As such, we cannot have anything in our plan that discriminates in our favor. A lower-paid employee can have all kinds of things that discriminates in his favor, as opposed to the higher paid, but the reverse is not true. I get a little choked up at times when I hear that engineers are, quote, higher paid employees. Since I started my working career not too far from here in the New York Central Railroad as a plumber, and I have figured that at any time since the beginning of my career, had I stayed a plumber working in New York City, I would be doing substantially better than I'm doing now as an engineer or a manager of engineers. At $12.70 an hour in New York City, they're not doing too bad. And in fact, I testified to that extent before the Ways and Means Committee, so it is now a matter of record that I, Dick Bach, have said that I would rather have been a plumber than an engineer. Unfortunately, in Washington, D.C., the word plumber has achieved a new connotation lately, and I'm not at all sure that I like the fact that that's in the congressional record. But notwithstanding, we do have that status under the common interpretation of the law, and we've got to live with it. The lower-paid people also have a special status under NLRB regulations in that they, as non-exempt employees, can be unionized, as we can also. But as a practical matter, the non-exempt employees seek unionization as a means to solve their problems of all kinds, pay and benefits. Now, I do not say that because they do go into such unions, they have in fact solved their pension problem. But they have within their grasp, under the present law, the ability to solve it if they wanted to. They could use their unions to achieve the kind of pensions they wanted because, A, they are a large workforce and can negotiate with their employer to get it, and, B, they could achieve preferential status under the present law. As engineers, we normally do not unionize. Our poll that many of you might be familiar with, the 1972 survey, showed that over 90% of engineers did not want to become unionized. The reasons for them not wanting to become unionized are probably very individualistic. It is indisputable that if you do seek collective bargaining as one way of solving your problem, you're going to carve out about 30% of IEEE's membership, because that's probably the minimum number of IEEE members that would fall above a line that normally characterizes management. And they would be left out of that collective bargaining group below that line that would be categorized as the working engineers. Now, as individuals, you can decide whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, but I just say that you lose about 30% of your members by doing that, and perhaps those members that might be the most articulate in your defense, and perhaps those members that might be the hardest workers to do something about this problem, because those 30% that were managers in 1970 found that they were not immune to being laid off, and that they, in fact, were also losing pensions. The problem would appear to be, then, that since we've got this high degree of mobility, and since vesting intervals are so long and create the most significant part of our problem, that, hell, the answer is simple. We'll just mandate immediate vesting for all workers in the United States. Then you have no discrimination, and you've got a certain amount of money being put away for everybody, and under those conditions, we will all have wonderful pension plans, and we will retire and go trolling in Florida on some little boat with our Evinrude motor behind us and a fly fishing hat on our head. And what is the problem with this? Because after all, down deep, we secretly know that within the coffers of big business is enough money to pay to do that, if they really want it. We know that, and we can get them to pay for it. And the bad guys generally turn out to be big business or big industry whenever you talk about the pension forfeiture problem. At least this is what normally shows up. But if you look at the testimony that was given before all of the congressional committees that had hearings on this subject, it was very interesting to see that a lot of other groups came in for raps, And I would say on an almost page-for-page basis, big business and big labor unions took equal lumps. The labor unions that are, in theory, and in many cases, in fact, spokesmen for the workers, haven't really done a better job in devising pension plans that are useful than big business has. So you're on a somewhat slippery ground if you say big business has been the fall guy for this, or should be the fall guy for this. They have created the problem. A lot of things have happened since the private pension system was devised around the turn of the century. Just look at the cost of the Social Security system, which was originally intended to provide a floor above which private pensions were going to be built. And the employer that believed that starts putting 2, 3, 4, 5% away, thinking that's an acceptable level of contribution to a private pension system, because after all, we all remember when we were only putting 1% into Social Security or 2%, as God certainly intended, and now look at a rate that's almost 6%. In 1934 or 35, when the Social Security system was devised, everyone knew it was a communist plot. Now it has become a very acceptable adjunct to the private pension system, and the result is there has been a great expansion in the cost and the employer's overhead. But I still say big business is the bad guy, because they've got the money to do something about the problem if they wanted to. Well, if you believe the figures that are published by the Commerce Department and by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and others, you probably will not agree with that concept. And now I'm going to get into an area where I am clearly an amateur, but it doesn't stop me from plunging ahead anyway, because angels go in where, et cetera, et cetera. This is the area where actuaries and accountants dominate. And I've asked actuaries and I've asked accountants to give me some approximate idea of what it would cost in the United States if we went to immediate vesting. If every man, woman, and child at work got into a pension plan and you got immediate vesting. Now, I have reports on file that belabor that issue for over 100 pages, and at the end of it, they conclude that we can't really give you a simple answer to that question. And I have to say that my definition of accountant probably is very accurate based on that kind of response. Because the way I define an accountant is someone that would rather be precisely incorrect than approximately correct. And I'm really just looking for an approximately correct answer here. It looks like if we went to immediate vesting in all pension plans in the United States, the cost of the plan would approximately double. Now, depending on whether you look at just funding future liabilities or funding current liabilities, contributions now range between $10 and $15 billion. And therefore, if we say the costs of plans are going to double, we mean that employers would have to contribute an additional $10 to $15 billion to the private pension system annually. And the total profits of companies in the United States run somewhere around $60 billion. Now, you can just imagine how rapidly and how willingly U.S. industry would, or in fact should, accept a $10 to $15 billion dilution out of a total of $60 billion in profit. So who's going to really pay for it? Where's the money really going to come from? We can insist that this be done. Over a period of time, the legislation may become that progressive. And that cost, as surely as God made green apples, is going to be passed along to every one of us in the form of an increased cost of goods and products that we buy from these industries. And if we fail to do that, our government, being provident on our behalf, is going to increase coverage under the Social Security system. And who is going to pay the cost of that? We, as individual taxpayers, are going to bear that through a Social Security assessment, or as being discussed now, through a special assessment coming out of general revenues. And I say under both of those situations, we engineers will suffer, because both of those will address the problems of the so-called lower-paid employee, or the average-paid employee in the United States, and anyone making more than, in 1974 dollars, approximately $10,000, is going to pay a disproportionate share of the cost of that system. So if we've been taking the raps all along for being higher-paid employees, then we ought to support a system that, in fact, is going to permit us to have a higher-than-average pension. And the only way to do that is to recognize some of the rather serious financial problems employers face in providing such coverage, and recognize that there isn't anybody else to pay for that system but the U.S. taxpayer or the U.S. consumer or we as individual employees.
This ends side one of this cassette program. To continue, stop the machine, turn the cassette over, and you should be correctly cued for side two.